Well, welcome to
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Carol the Coach Show. Hey, this is the show called Sex Help with Carol the Coach, and it is Memorial Day. And so we are going to be replaying a very popular show. And so while you all are just listening on the computer, I want you to know that the holidays can be rough and tough, and they can give you a lot of extra time on your hands. But I'm telling you, if you listen to the show, you will find the skills you need to make your life better. Now, here comes the replay.
Hi, I'm Carol Jurgensen-Sheets, commonly known as Carol the Coach, and tonight I'm excited to be interviewing Dr. Joe Court. You know, Joe is a man with a wealth of knowledge in the field of sexual addiction, and tonight we're going to be cracking the erotic code. Recovery from sexual addiction is possible with some of Joe's words of wisdom. So, Joe, welcome to the call.
Hi, Carol. Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. Now, you say everyone has sexual fantasies and interests, all of which have non-sexual meanings. Can you share a little bit about that? What do you mean?
So, you know, it's commonly known, you know, we talk about an arousal template, sort of like a love map. Everyone has a love map, so they have a certain type that they're attracted to, a certain kind of partner they're looking for. And so people also have an arousal map, the kinds of sexual fantasies, desires, behaviors, things that turn them on, arouse them. And so all of that builds on the preferences, our sexual preferences. And they come from somewhere. And I always say, you know, if you have a room of 100 people, no two people are going to have the exact same arousal template. And that's because they're two specific, very individual people with very different histories.
Okay, so the non-sexual meaning, what does that mean?
So it means, the idea of it is that we're all drawn to certain kinds of interests that come from non-sexual places. So I was trained in doing this thing called Imago relationship therapy, and what I like about that is it says that the person you're attracted to, the person you fall in love with, it's not an accident. It's like custom made love. And the same is true about our arousal templates, that the things that we're turned on by is custom made. It develops from our childhood. It develops from the things that imprint upon us as we are growing up and during our developmental years.
100%. And so if you've experienced trauma, you may have a love map or an arousal template that in some way mimics what you grew up with and also what your interests are. And you're saying that they may have a non-sexual meaning.
Yes. Right. So for sure in a sexual abuse situation or a sexual trauma, the non-sexual meaning would be that trauma. So, for instance, it would then shape somebody's arousal template. So I see this a lot. I say that my clients are returning to the scene of the crime, meaning the crime occurred from sexual trauma, sexual abuse. So, for instance, I had a client, and he acted out sexually in bathrooms and rest stops and rest areas with other males, and the exact way that he acted out with them was exactly how he was sexually abused as a child by his father.
Well, that makes all the sense in the world. And they probably don't even know that they are reenacting that childhood trauma.
Not at all.
Now, with Imago therapy, obviously, we pick our partners based on our childhood and what we witnessed from our own parents. So you believe that people develop arousal templates based on their childhood issues and their childhood origin.
Yes.
Okay.
And that, so for instance, I know this, some of the ways I talk are going to sound very simplistic, and people are going to say, oh, you know, as if there's some kind of a menu or some kind of a direct link for everyone. And for everyone, it's very different. I think about these whole, you know what MILFs are? Have you ever heard of that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's a very arousing fantasy for a lot of straight men, for these cougar women or women that have been mothers. And what I tell people is I think that has a lot to do with how they were mothered. Their desire to be closer, not to have sex with their mother at all, I don't mean it in that way, but to have some kind of approval from a mother figure, from somebody who has kids, that there's a link to something about their childhood with their adult female caretakers.
Now, that makes total sense. Do you typically work with men because you're doing a lot of speaking from a man's point of view, or do you work with women too?
I do work with both, but I do admit that I do work more with men, both straight and gay, to help them understand this, because so many men these days are coming in because they've been caught on the internet or their spouse or partner found pornography, and they don't even understand why it is they're looking at what they're looking at.
Right. And when you say their partner has found pornography, I'm sure that that encompasses all types of pornography, but especially gay pornography.
Yes. You mean as far as gay and straight men or gay men?
Well, I was speaking about straight men that where their partners have found this gay pornography. I know that a lot of people out there really believe that if you are looking at pornography and you're a male and it's male pornography, you must be gay.
I know.
And that's not true at all.
It's not true. And I know people want to look at that as so simplistic. It's so reductionist. You know, it's like saying gay people who look at straight porn are latently heterosexual, and they're not. A lot of the men, the straight men, they're looking at gay porn for so many different reasons, and it depends on what kind of porn, what the men are doing in the porn. You know, I have a whole litany of questions I ask that lead us back to what it could be about. So, for instance, I had one guy come to me. He was looking at medical porn, meaning the pornography you can see is there's a doctor, a male doctor comes in and he's giving an exam to a male patient,
mm-hmm.
and then it turns sexual.
Mm-hmm.
And there's site after site after site, and of course his wife found this and thought that he's got to be gay. Why is he looking at this? Well, it turned out that as a child, all the boys in his neighborhood, including him, he was sexually abused by a male doctor in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Boy, that was my very first thought, and yet you're right. The normal person would think he's got to be gay as opposed to realizing that something happened in his childhood that he was reenacting again.
Exactly. And I know we're talking a lot about trauma, but what I like to do, even with people who come in who don't have sexual issues, if I ask them to talk about their fantasies, talk about their desires, it doesn't matter whether you've had trauma, whether you're a therapy client, or whether you have just totally healthy, vanilla sexual fantasies, they can all help you link back to your past.
Okay, so then one of the questions you would ask a client is, tell me about your sexual fantasies and your desires. And so in what way does this help somebody either understand their sexuality or understand their addiction if they are addicted to sex?
Well, I want to make it clear that I've never found, and research doesn't support this either, you can't change your sexual fantasies. You can add to them.
Mm-hmm.
The template's something you can add to, but it's not something that necessarily can change. You can definitely change the compulsivity around it.
Mm-hmm.
So what I've been able to do with people is, it's sort of like like there's an erotic intelligence. So it's trying to tell you something. It's like a dream. That's another way I look at it. Like Freud used to say that the road to discovering your inner self is through your dreams, and I don't believe that. I think the road to discovering your inner self is through your sexual fantasies. And you look at the sexual fantasies like a dream. They're themes, they're symbols. Everything has a meaning, and it has a meaning other than what you're looking at, other than what you're thinking about. And that meaning is different for every single person. So I had one guy, and I'm not sure, I'll try not to be too graphic, because I know people, I want to be respectful of what people listening, but when people come in, they're very graphic, and this one man was interested in having performing oral sex on another man, or actually another man giving him oral sex, to the point where the person giving oral sex was doing it to the point where they couldn't breathe at times, maybe a few seconds of their breath being held.
That asphyxiation feeling.
Yes. But in his mind, in my client's mind, what he was doing is taking their breath away.
Okay.
All right. So mm-hmm. Now he didn't know this. I'm fishing around. I'm talking with him about what's the most exciting, what's his peak erotic experience. You know, what about that experience causes him to have the most arousing, the most arousing point. And then when we linked it back to his childhood, he was a product of a lot of emotional neglect. His parents were not affectionate. They were not loving. They didn't show their affection. And so he felt his experience of his parents were that he never took their breath away.
So he was really trying to create something he had never experienced.
Exactly. He was trying to reconcile the irreconcilable.
Mm-hmm. So then what did you do with that man? Because obviously he needed a lot of nurturance and a lot of understanding.
He did. And so what I always tell therapists is this then becomes the treatment plan. His work now was grieving and feeling and looking back and knowing what it felt like for him then to not be able to take their breath away.
Mm-hmm.
To not be that important or that loved. And it sounds harsh, but that is where he was. And now the work can point him to getting that outside of the sexual realm. Because when he came to me, he was compulsively engaging in that sexual behavior. But at the same time, he was saying to me, I want a boyfriend. Well, you're not going to get a boyfriend that way. You know, guys who are wanting to do that want to have one-night hookups. They're not wanting a boyfriend.
Mm-hmm. So actually, he had to learn how to not subdue that behavior, but how to meet that need in other ways so that he could then get what he really wanted out of life.
Right, in non-sexual ways. And so it doesn't mean that when he found a partner that they didn't engage in that behavior, that still turned him on, but it wasn't something compulsive, and he didn't have to lead with that sexual behavior.
Well, and so in this way, it helped him to stop acting out so he really could get what he needed as opposed to act out and hope that he got what he needed.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. And so that's really important for sex addicts or any of us who have behaviors that are beginning to become compulsive.
Compulsive, troublesome. It's almost like people say, I'm doing these behaviors and it's against my own will.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I say to them, that's because probably whatever you're acting out was against your will, you know, or happened to you without your consent in childhood. And it doesn't have to be traumatic. It doesn't have to be something even bad, but something that didn't get resolved.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that every single person is different, but as you worked with this client, did that take extensive long-term therapy?
It did. With him, it did. And some of it is because I know I'm making it sound so easy that I ask about sexual desires and fantasies. That can take a long time for people to be comfortable doing. You know, they have questions up to me. Are you being a voyeur? Why do you want to know this? Where are you coming from? And really, I'm coming from helping them understand not the erotic part, but the non-erotic parts.
Yeah, and so clearly you had to develop that trust and then find out about the desires and then show him how he was actually sabotaging what he needed out of life and work then with that behavior, making it less and less, and then teaching him how to get what he really needed, which was not from a one-night stand, but from a relationship.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, and so, the internet is just, you know, we've always said, I remember before the internet, in the 80s, and when I was an upcoming therapist in training, you know, they said our biggest sex organ was between our ears. And that is so true. So we're seeing it come live on the internet. Everything between our ears, our brain, is now being put on the internet. People are saying things they would have never said, they would have never typed, they would have never looked at. And I just don't think it's an accident that that where your sexual preferences lead you. I think it's all coming from an internal map and an awakening to other things about yourself. So I've had guys come to me, straight men, who are having all kinds of promiscuous sex, but at the same time, they're saying something that's not congruent. They're saying, but I want to get married. I want to have a wife. But what they're doing is having different sexual hookups with different women. And so for some of the men that come in, what I look at immediately is, are they using sex as a way to feel that they exist?
Mm-hmm.
Are they using sex as a way to feel attached to somebody? Because sexual activity, sexual feelings make us feel attached to that other person. But it's not a real attachment. You and I both know that. It's a pseudo-attachment without the depth of having a real relationship with that person.
Right, the intimacy, the emotional intimacy.
Exactly. And something sometimes a lot of the men that are coming to me avoid because intimacy in their childhood was fraught with emotional pain, maybe emotional neglect.
Right. In a way, it's a way to fill that need temporarily, but they're not really getting the intimacy that they need. Therefore, they're constantly searching.
Exactly.
And that creates that compulsivity.
It does, and especially because it's unknown to them. It's completely unconscious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so for anybody who doesn't know, Dr. Cord is a board-certified sex therapist. He's a certified sex addictions therapist. He's a certified Imago relationship therapist, and he's the author of 3 books. And the books that you've written are?
The first one was 10 Smart Things Gay Men Can Do to Improve Their Lives.
Mm-hmm.
Then I wrote a book for gay men in their relationships with a similar title, 10 Smart Things Gay Men Can Do to Find Real Love. And then the third one was for therapists working with gays and lesbians called Gay Affirmative Therapy for the Straight Clinician.
Now, is that something that you coined, the Gay Affirmative Therapy?
No, I wish it was, because I'd be famous. No, I actually don't remember where I think it's in the book who coined it, but no, it's been around for quite a while. And there's been a lot of books written on gay affirmative therapy, but a lot of therapists would say, well, that's for gay therapists.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, when I wrote my book, I said to the publisher, make sure it says for the straight clinician,
mm-hmm.
so they'd be willing to pick it up.
Well, and it's interesting because even in this field, when you're talking about sexual fantasies and desires and being interested in same-sex partners versus, you know, heterosexuals, we don't know enough about the desires and the fantasies, and they're at the core of a lot of this behavior.
It's so true.
You know, just the other day, I noticed that both you and I responded to a colleague who was very disturbed because she had heard that women enjoyed rape, that rape fantasies were very common. And you and I both know that rape fantasies are very common, but they are not the fantasies of an actual rape.
Exactly.
They're the fantasies of submission and of being taken, and, you know, that it doesn't have to do with the blood and the guts and, you know, fearing for your life and all the trauma that accompanies an actual rape.
Exactly.
But that fantasy is very, very different. Now, what do you find with that rape fantasy that women so oftentimes have? What do you see with their desires?
They feel so ashamed. You know, they come to the office, they are ashamed for, because they'll often feel like, this is so anti-feminist. I would never want this to happen in real life. And I always say, of course you wouldn't want it to happen in real life. But a lot of the women that come to my office that have those fantasies have had patriarchal fathers. They could have had even a patriarchal mother, you know, very dominant, over-masculine, or sort of emotionally intrusive caretakers, parental figures. And so in their attempt to not have that happen in their life, they have eroticized it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Or in my practice, what I've seen is that sex has been so taboo in their early childhood, and they've been told, no, you don't, and don't even think about it, no fantasies, and don't touch yourself, that that's their only way of really enjoying sexual fantasies is to have been overtaken by somebody else because they can't allow that for themselves.
That's excellent. I totally agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so it relieves them of the responsibility.
Right, and all that guilt they have for doing it anyway.
Right, someone else made me do it, and even if it's just a fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is really important for any listener. It's not about women wanting to be raped. It's not about asking for it. It's a fantasy. I've had some of the most prominent gay activists tell me that they who are all about gay pride, but in the bedroom, they want to be humiliated. They want to be degraded. That's not what they really want in life. It's sort of like what's erotic and arousing is what's most taboo.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So can you give some examples of that? I understand that you want to respect people's boundaries, but at the same time, if we don't talk about it, then nobody talks about it.
Exactly, it's true.
Yeah. So give us some examples of how you worked with people who had some sexual acting out and how you helped them by letting them understand that there was some non-sexual meanings to their behaviors and fantasies.
Sure, no, I definitely will. I want to quote a really good line from a book called Mating in Captivity. Have you ever read that book?
Mm-hmm.
Esther Perel, and she says this line, and I love it. Tell me how you were loved as a child, and I will tell you how you make love as an adult. I love that, and I lead with all my talks that way, and I tell my clients that. So I had this one client. They came to me, and his acting out, he'd been caught, he was heterosexual, he was married, they were expecting their first child, and he was caught flashing women with an erect penis and making gestures to them with his mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he got away with it, Finally, a woman decided you're not going to get away with it anymore and contacted the police, and so then he was mandated to come to therapy, and he was very ashamed. His wife, of course, was very shocked and felt very betrayed. What was this behavior? And so what my first job was doing a history, a thorough history. Tell me about your mother. Tell me about your father. And as we're going through the history, I'm getting a sense of why would he need to have this exhibitionist behavior? You know, why does he need to see a woman's shocked look? What his peak erotic experiences were when she would see it and she would have her response. And then he could get away from her and masturbate thinking about that.
Mm-hmm.
He came from a family of women who, starting at the top with his mother, who hated men. We all know the word for the hatred of women. That's misogyny. But most people don't know the hatred of men is misandry.
Hmm.
And so his mother was very misandrous, and she had raised her daughters to be very misandrous, and the father was passive and weak and didn't do anything about it, never stood up to his wife, never stood up for the sons. So he was emasculated, my client was emasculated, silenced, told just look cute and don't talk, don't say anything. And so he sort of went into the world without a healthy sense of masculinity, without being honored and blessed by a woman, his mother figure, for the man and the male that he was. So in his acting out, what we found, the link was, he kept reinforcing, see I'm a man. Even though this really wasn't a blessing, erotically it was for him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that then turned us to the work, which was him standing up to his mother, standing up to his sisters, asserting himself to his wife in a way that he'd never done before, and going to a men's workshop and claiming his masculinity in a way that he was not able to do, obviously, as a child.
And was that a warrior movement that he had to go through?
Yeah, it was. It was. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because, you know, Hugh, he has never, I mean, it's amazing that he had any self-esteem at all. Because mm-hmm. when you're pivotal, parent doesn't really accept or like your sexuality, your gender, your whatever, you're going to really doubt yourself. And of course, it makes sense that because he was so confused and self-doubting, he did just the opposite. He reenacted a situation where he was really on top.
Exactly. And he didn't even know, he didn't even have a sense of how he was raised. That didn't even enter his mind. And it's like the unconscious is knocking on the door saying, here, I'm going to tell you the story over and over again until you figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was obviously very dangerous. I mean, he got into legal trouble. And when I see the more dangerous the behavior, the more serious I know the childhood situation must be, or the more that the person is trying to protect their perpetrator. And so it's sort of like terrorism. You know, they're sort of protecting. They're willing to die for their cause kind of thing. And a lot of my clients with the most serious acting out, that's where they're at. They're willing to die to protect the perpetrators.
Now, that's interesting. So, again, the more disturbing, the more legally offensive, then the more likely you're going to see real trauma and you're going to see a reaction formation, if you will.
Exactly. That's good. That's well said. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that makes sense, too. So for anybody who's listening who may have some guilt and shame about their hidden behaviors, what would you say to them?
I really like to say to people, I really believe that where we are coming from has positive intent. I know things are pathological. Our behaviors can be pathological. Personalities can have pathology. Of course they can. But I really believe that it's all coming from a positive intent, an attempt to heal, an attempt to understand. It just comes out wrong. And so to really help them have some forgiveness, to have some compassion for themselves, and then from that, if they could say to themselves, all right, let me try to understand. You know, a lot of men, I have a lot of straight men who come in and they've posted pictures of their wives naked or taken pictures of their wives' body parts and post them on the Internet. And a lot of people say, well, they hate their wives and they hate women. And maybe, but why do we, I can understand we go there first. It's a reaction, it's sort of a knee-jerk reaction. But let's take a minute and let me try to understand, and I want people to try to say to themselves, do I hate my wife or am I angry about something and I've taken it out on her?
Mm-hmm.
You know, who is she standing in for?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that's what ends up happening is we end up taking our most angriest moments out on the people we love the most.
Mm-hmm. And obviously when you scapegoat your partner like that, then you're actually able to, in some ways, heal the wound to the best of your ability, even though, again, it's sabotaging that intimacy.
Yes, and I wouldn't even say heal the wound. It's an attempt to heal the wound, but instead all you're doing is getting some momentary, temporary relief.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this work is so difficult in that, you know, it's not short-term therapy. And yet it may be the first time an individual has ever been understood. And you remind me of, you know, a puzzle maker, because you really put all the pieces together and you start out again at birth and look at those early developmental relationships.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So yes. That takes a lot of patience, both for you and for the client.
It does, and it takes a lot of commitment that a lot of people don't want to make time for, it because either they're scared or they think it's going to lead to something negative. And I have found that even if it does, we'll turn it into something positive and productive.
Well, your positive attitude, I would think, would be a great sell to clients. I mean, they would feel that genuine compassion and that desire to be that person that helps them figure it all out.
Well, thank you. But I also, you know, I'm a recovering sex addict, and
mm-hmm.
honestly, I did every single thing that was asked of me in my recovery, the 12 steps. I trained. I went to treatment with Patrick Carnes. I read all the books. I did every single thing that was asked of me, and it helped a little bit. Everything helped a little bit. But what helped me the most is when I sat down with a therapist who said, the only way I'm going to be able to help you is to know every detail of your sexual fantasies. It's embedded in those is going to be the core details of what we need to work on. It took me a year to trust her and to really believe that she had a positive intent for me.
Now, do you think it mattered that it was a female therapist?
For me, it did matter. That's why it took me a year. I think if it had been a male therapist, it might have been easier. So I'm not sure. I think the gender of the therapist does matter. The orientation, sexual orientation probably matters.
Uh-huh.
I get a lot of straight men who come to me and say, I'm coming to you because I'm too embarrassed to tell a woman about this, and I'm certainly not going to tell a straight therapist about my sexual fantasies. I'm too embarrassed.
Right, right.
And they think just because I'm gay that I'm going to be okay with it. And I am okay with that, but there's a lot of gay therapists that wouldn't be.
Mm-hmm. So then, because of your own recovery work and because you understood the shame, the guilt, the confusion, you are able, probably telepathically, empathetically, you're more able to be able to work with somebody and understand that wounding.
Absolutely, and that's why I can be so positive and hopeful, because somebody was for me.
Well, and look what it did for you. I mean, anybody who's, again, listening to this podcast, if you research certified sexual addiction therapists, you'll find that Joe is truly one of the most well-known therapists in the community, and my goodness, you've had so much airplay. You've done all sorts of shows. You've really made it your mission to educate and be a pioneer in this field, because it is a relatively new field.
It really is. Isn't it interesting? Really, they've been talking about sexuality since the 1800s, and only recently, in the last 20 years, do we have any advancement.
Yes, 100%. So you decided to go back and get your doctorate in clinical sexology, and was that before or after you became a certified sexual therapist, sexual addiction therapist?
After. Yeah, I was doing, all of my work was pretty much around sexual negativity, sexual trauma, sexual wounding, and I felt I was so well trained, but I was sort of, in all that training, we were sort of left off with, okay, now that we've gotten them healed, how do you help them have a good sex life? And everyone's like, I don't know. You know, and I was like, well, I don't know either. And I started to look around, and I started feeling directed and pointed to sex therapy and the positive side of sex therapy, and helping people feel good about their sex lives and their sexual selves. So, and it's so interesting because In sex therapy, there's a lot of arguments that sex addiction doesn't exist. And in the sexual addiction community, there's a lot of arguments about what sexual health looks like. And I kind of like standing in the middle and looking at both sides. Because I think it's different for every person that we're sitting across.
Well, and that is such an important element to help people create healthy erotic sex lives with themselves and their partners. And that's definitely a part of what you do as they're healing and after they heal. Because I would think until you've done some of the healing, that would almost be impossible.
I agree. It is.
Mm-hmm.
There's too much darkness. There's too much leaking of the negativity. And so any attempt towards sexual health is sort of interrupted by the darkness of the sexual trauma.
So then how do you begin to do that with a client? What are some expectations that a client might have once they have healed?
Well, so what happens is, so for a sex addict, they'll start to have various sexual encounters, and they'll come in and they'll say, oh, I acted out, and they'll tell me something they did, and I'll say, is that acting out? You know, we have the three circles, the inner circle, the middle circle, and the outer circle in sex addiction recovery. And what I love about those circles is it's fluid. So, you can be moving things in and out, up and down. And so a client will look at me and say, well, what do you mean? And I'll say, well, I know that anonymous sexual behaviors was a compulsive acting out for you and you're acting out. But now it sounds like you chose this person. It sounds like you thought about it, that it wasn't compulsive. You're single. It makes sense that you'd want to have a sexual connection. You know, I try to reframe it and really ask together and sit with this person and say, is this really still sexual acting out, or is this part of your sexual health?
And so in trying to figure that out, then you reframe it for them, and then they're able to feel like, yeah, maybe that is part of what I need right now, and it's not driving me compulsively to go back.
Exactly.
To that other circle.
Exactly, because sometimes for other people, it's masturbation was a problem. It was compulsive. It was too much. It was an attempt to self-soothe, and they didn't have any other way. And so then in their recovery, you know, so they may have stopped masturbating for a long period of time, and then they'll come in and say, oh, I slipped, I masturbated. Was it a slip? Or maybe this was a healthy outlet now that you've gotten away from the unhealthy outlet. So I'm always open to, maybe I'm wrong, maybe it's not healthy, but I want them to also be open to maybe they're wrong and maybe it was healthy.
Mm-hmm. Now, you and I both know that internet pornography can be the crack cocaine.
Yes.
Of the internet, and yet at the same time, do you ever see that as being healthy?
Yeah, see, yes, and this is controversial, I know, but absolutely. Porn might be what is the sexual acting out that gets you into treatment and gets you into trouble and may have become a problem, but that doesn't mean that after the compulsivity and the treatment effectively helps you heal that you can't look at porn again. It might mean that. But it's not like alcoholism where you can never go back to a drink. Although some people do drink alcoholically, do abuse it, and then in their lives they are able to go back to drinking. There are people who can do that. And there are people who have sexual acting out with porn who can go back to looking at porn. They may not be able to look at everything they looked at. They may have to have different rules and boundaries around it. But I do always say this to people, is it really worth the risk? I mean, what if you're not that person?
I agree with you, and yet I love the fact that you are controversial because I don't think everything is black and white.
Right, I don't either.
And the guilt that a client will end up feeling, especially they feel guilty if they don't feel guilty.
I know. That's true.
Yeah, and so I'm glad to see that you really ask them, because you've spent months and months, years and years helping them to heal, to really take a look at how is it affecting them now.
Right. How is it affecting them personally? And, you know, it's hard because we're sitting here talking. We're speaking very generally. I do my talks. I'm writing very generally. But every single person, I don't feel like I can tell anybody who they are or what's right or wrong for them. That's a hit or miss as we go forward in the work.
Well, I agree. But don't you think as a therapist, oftentimes, now I'm going to dispute what you just said.
Sure.
There are times that somebody will begin to have some dangerous behavior again, and they'll be in denial. And so you're kind of the wake-up call of, hey, I don't know about you, but you look awful happy about this behavior, and you're talking about two other behaviors it led to.
Yes.
Let's take a look at that before you fall too deep.
Yeah, and I probably do sound too permissive, of course. Absolutely. I have to take a stand. I had a guy come to me once. He was HIV positive. He was a gay client.
Uh-huh.
And he kept going back to the baths, back to the rest areas, back to high-risk behavior. He was allowing himself to be receive anal sex unprotected. And I kept saying to him, this is dangerous behavior. I can't be okay with this. I'll listen to you, but every time you bring it up, I'm going to let you know this is really dangerous. You keep allowing yourself to be possibly reinfected. We don't know exactly what that means once you're infected. You're infecting other people. I mean, this is really dangerous behavior. I'm not okay with it.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right.
Mm-hmm. And what state do you work out of?
In Michigan.
Okay. So in Michigan, are there report laws for that?
Yeah, there are.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there are. So definitely I'll tell a client, you know, look, if you're going to, since you did this, I'm going to have to report this. This
mm-hmm.
is really, really dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those clients, like I said earlier, are the ones that have the most serious neglect and trauma.
Right. Like you said, exactly. The more dangerous it is, the more trauma they've had. And I do believe that on some level they're seeing if you're going to abandon them too.
Yeah, true.
Mm-hmm. So then, going back to cracking the erotic code, recovery from sexual addiction, would you give us your definition of what you see as sexual addiction?
Yeah, that's it's when you're it's not. I would say it's not about sex; it's the abuse of sex.
Okay.
It's going against one's own will, not being able to predict on a regular and consistent basis how much sex you want, how often you want it. Doing things that go against your values and your own will. And I know that there are people that say, well, that's what sex is all about. It's about going against what you, if you're gay pride during the day or female women's rights during the day, then at night you're, you know, allowing yourself to be a whore or to be, you know, whatever. That's true. But, and a lot of people do feel ashamed of their sexual fantasies. What I'm talking about, when I think of sexual addiction, I think of somebody doing things over and over again and feeling out of control and being out of control with it.
Mm-hmm. So if they're feeling out of control and if they're preoccupied and if it's really interfering with their day and maybe they're taking legal risks, illegal risks, that is sexual addiction.
Yes, or health risks, yeah, or marital risks or job risks, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So you do work with a lot of men who are experimenting with homosexuality and bisexuality, and you have always said this does not mean these men are gay.
Actually, I haven't always said that. I've come to know that in the last 10 years. Probably if someone had come to me over 10 years ago, I would have said, oh, I think you're probably gay, just because of the act. I had to be convinced by seeing client after client, straight man after straight man. They've come into my office. They'd be holding my books from a well-intended therapist who referred my books to them and was trying to help them come out. And these men walk into my office and they say, if I'm gay, help me be gay. I've done everything I can to see if I'm gay and to work in that way. I don't feel it. I don't connect to men in this way. It's just in this sexual realm, in this one sexual way. And I started seeing too many clients like that, and I started to realize these men aren't gay. They're reenacting something, they're maybe have a sexual interest in male-on-male sex, they might have, I call it a homosexual imprint. When I say homosexual imprint, I don't mean identity, it's a behavioral imprint. So they're reenacting that early trauma of somebody who might have sexually abused them or had some kind of a gender abuse. Sometimes their masculinity being assaulted by being called names can cause them to want to gain mastery over their masculinity and having same sex.
That's interesting. I have a client right now, and he actually was involved in child porn, and he went to jail. Of course, he was a teacher, you know, and he really had a lot of questions about his sexuality and believes that that was the driver of the fascination and the compulsion to look at young boys' bodies because that's where he was arrested developmentally.
Oh, interesting.
In the meantime, he has a loving, caring relationship with his wife. She's wonderful. They do marital enrichment classes, and he says, I love marriage. I love my wife. I really believe that a lot of my pain came from being called a sissy and being called a fag and being called gay in my childhood, and I didn't necessarily feel that way, but it led to driving me towards a curiosity. And so he continues to really look at, what is he? Is he gay? Is he bi? Is he heterosexual? And so it sounds like you're telling me, Carol, go back and really look and see if there's any major childhood trauma or neglect or abuse so that we can identify what is going on.
Yes. I think neglect is underrated. I think sometimes neglect is worse than abuse, because abuse, at least people can remember it. They saw it. They felt it. There was an exchange with another person. Neglect is like the invisible man. And so I think a lot of people with neglect spend more time in therapy than those who've been abused, because you're trying to uncover something that is invisible.
Mm-hmm. That makes total sense. Now, one of the things I did was I referred him to a men's group that was primarily gay. And he said, you know, I feel so safe in this group because they're men that are very nurturing and loving and caring, but I don't feel gay. I'm not attracted to one of them.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So,
you know, there's a really good word I learned in my sexology courses called cathexis. Have you ever heard that word?
Mm-mm.
I love it. It's an old word, but I love it. I don't know why we stopped using it in our field. Cathexis is the sexual, romantic, and erotic attraction you have to the opposite sex, to the same sex, or to both.
Okay, so say that one more time. It's cathexis. I can't even say it.
I know. It's cathexis.
Cathexis.
C-A-T-H-E-X-I-S, cathexis.
Okay.
And it's really, how do you cathect? Do you cathect toward men? Do you cathect toward women? You cathect toward both. So my psychology professor, Dr. William Granzig, loved this man. He and I argued a lot during this, because he didn't believe in sexual addiction. He didn't believe in male bisexuality. And I do believe, of course, in both. So we went round and round and round. And finally he said, look, if you're going to be out there and you're talking about men who have sex with men, you're doing it wrong. You're getting involved in political debates with people, and it's true. I get a lot of hate mail from a lot of gay men who say, all I'm doing is trying to keep gay men closeted. And that's not what I'm doing at all. I'm talking about straight men. So he said, I'm going to teach you this word. I want you to start using it. The word is cathexis.
Mm-hmm.
It takes it totally away from politics, and it leaves it up to the person. And how they cathect is personal to them, and it can't change.
Mm-hmm. That makes total sense. And, you know, again, that's that black and white thinking. It's got to be A or B. And what you're really saying is, no, it doesn't. Not at all.
Not at all. And I totally know also why he didn't believe in male bisexuality, because men don't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And women do. Women talk about it, and men love it. Straight men love the whole idea of women with women. And so men with men is a whole different ballgame, and it's very shaming in our culture.
And do you have an opinion about what gay men love in terms of, do they love women on women? Does that in any way, shape, or form provide a turn-on?
No. I think one of the major turn-on I notice with gay men is straight men.
Okay.
And I think for them, if we look at arousal template, it's if they can, turn on a straight man, or be able to be sexual with a straight man, or be able to flirt with a straight man and get his approval, then that straight man is standing in for all the other straight men in this gay man's life who never approved of him.
Hmm, that's interesting.
It's really similar to women who love gay men. So she can release all her sexual energy, and there's a lot of women that chase down gay men. And, oh, you're so much more attractive, you're so much more emotionally available to me, blah, blah, blah. But really, when you look at her arousal template, she's in a safe zone. The sexuality coming back to her is going to be sparse to none. And sometimes they do end up being able to get a gay man to be sexual with them. But it's there's no commitment there. It's not going to go anywhere.
Well, that makes total sense. Now, you know, you obviously have a niche, and that niche is working with gay and bisexual men, but you do work with heterosexual men and women.
I do.
And Are you ever bored by the woman who doesn't have a sexual addiction?
No. I can't even think of a client that I would be bored by. I can think of some clients I haven't really liked because of the way they've led their lives, and I may not have agreed with it, but not bored.
Well, there you go. And I know that, you know, people that are going to be listening to this call, this, we don't want this to be time sensitive, but will you talk just a second about the Gay Affirmative Therapy telecourses that you do, as well as some of the workshops that you periodically do?
Well, sure, I'd be happy to. I do teleclasses for straight clinicians, and gay clinicians can be on there as well. But just teaching them the thing, like a lot of therapists will say, I'm gay friendly. And I'm sure they are, that they'll say a couple is just a couple. And the truth is, it's not true. Two males in a relationship are very different than a man and a woman. And that's very different from two women. And so while there's a lot of overlap, there's a lot of things that are similar, there's a lot of things that aren't. And if you don't know those things, you're not going to be able to help that couple completely. Or if you don't understand what internalized homophobia looks like in your gay clients, then you're not going to be asking about it, you're not going to be looking for it, and your client's not going to come in and say, you know, I think I have internalized homophobia. They don't even know what that means.
Right.
You have to teach them that. So I do a lot of teleclasses with that, and I've been doing more teleclasses about and trainings on sexual addiction, but on sexual health as well, like we're doing right now, talking about both sides of it. Here's the trauma, here's how it happens, and here's how to get out of it, and here's how to have, you know, be positive about it.
Well, and I got to tell you, you know, I'm a personal life coach, and I also am a mental health therapist of 32 years, and decided to go into this work because I didn't feel that there were enough people that were open-minded enough to want to go into this field, and I knew there was a lot of healing. And I don't know if you're aware, but Dr. Carnes now, in his training, his last part of the sexual health is then to take people through a personal life coaching segment where they actually find their potential away from their sexuality, just in general, with their career, with their families, with their life. And, you know, this is such an evolving field, and it sounds like you are spending a lot of time educating people, both clinicians and patients, about what is healthy, what is not, what does it mean, how to reframe. I mean, you seem to be doing it all. Can you tell us about the Trust and Intimacy workshop that you have for men?
Yes, that is not something that that I'm leading. It's an associate that I have here who's leading it, and he has done a lot of men's work, something with the man, and I've done it actually myself, the Mankind Project. Have you heard of that?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, the New Warrior.
I was the woman within.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's so great. It's such a great, for both men and women. And he's bringing the things he's learned from that, and his whole thing is how men in general are punished, you know, sort of the work from Terrence Real, I don't want to talk about it, the punishment men have of denying their feelings, denying their relational attachments, causing havoc in their lives, and helping them connect to themselves, connect to other men. And he does a lot of shame work with men. You know, to acknowledge your feelings is shameful to men, to helping them relieve the shame. You know, acknowledging your loving feelings, letting women influence you, letting your wives influence you, and getting rid of that shame. So he's been doing one-day workshops, and I think he's going to keep doing them. I think he may even expand them into more than a day.
That's fantastic. How many colleagues do you have working with you?
I have two. I have a Felix Pollack. He's a straight male. And then I have Kelly Weller. She's a lesbian. And it's great because I would love to have another gay male therapist. I'd like to have I actually want to do what I've been trained to do, which is all the different things, have different expertise, and be able to offer the clients that come to me alternatives to just working with me.
Now, you also provide telephone and Skype coaching for long-distance clients. So how does that work?
Well, I just do coaching. I don't do phone or Skype therapy. I know that people do that, but I think I'm not comfortable with it. I just do coaching, which is that we don't spend a lot of time on people's paths. I don't require that they come weekly or every other week. Coaching is sort of as needed, and we spend really time on current life situations and problem solving. And ever since I wrote my books, I just started getting a lot of people who said, you know, I'd like to, I wish I could come to you, I wish you were here. And so now with Skype, I say to them, I can be there.
But again, that's for coaching and not for mental health therapy.
No,
I've never seen that. Not for sexual addiction.
No, no.
But I can see somebody coming to you and you consulting with them so that they get with the right professional and begin that journey.
I do that a lot. And actually, the people that contact me, they're already in therapy, they're in group, or they're in individual, and they contact me for their arousal template, let's say. So then I say, here's what I think, and then they bring that back to their therapist.
Makes a lot of sense. Yeah, this is, again, such a growing field, and we've got to reach out in all sorts of ways, and Skype is a great way to at least get that ball going.
Yeah, it is.
So now, in cracking the erotic code, is there anything else that you would like to say about recovering from sexual addiction and the work that you do with clients?
Just that there's a lot of hope, and I don't do enough with the female partners. I have it on my websites, and I haven't really put a lot on there yet. But I really want to help the straight spouses and the female spouses and the non-addicted spouses, the ones that are in relationship with people who are struggling, not to take it personally, not to see it as a result of a bad marriage. I know that it can be those things, but so much more. Often it's really about that person's personal journey, and there's something that they need to go through, and that the partner can decide to stay on the ride or not. But if they decide to stay on the ride and the partner's really doing the work, it's going to be the best ride of their life, because on the other side of it, they're both going to grow and they're both going to have a better connection to each other than they could have had otherwise. But yeah,
and I think that most people that would be listening to this, if there's a partner on the phone listening to this right now, if they've linked on in some way, they must be saying to themselves, Joe, is it worth it, you know, will he stay with me once he gets healthy?
Yeah, people do worry about that. And I have not, the worry is on both ends, even on the addict side. Are they going to stay with me after I get healthy? I think that that's the risk that people have to take, and I would hope they would take it, because there's personal growth to be taken by trying to stay together, by trying to work it through. It's just easier to leave. And it is. People say, well, I should just do that. It's easier. And I always say, it is easier, but you won't really have to have the opportunity to grow and heal.
Now, you have an A&E segment where a woman wants to express her anger about her husband who has discovered that he's gay.
Yes.
And how did that couple end up working out?
They ended up not working out.
Well, that's what I thought. As she's hugging him in the car and saying goodbye, you know, kind of reaching in, she realized that they couldn't be together because he needed, again, to work through his own journey. And that meant exploring his sexuality full time.
It really did. It really did. And that was sad. And you could see how sad it was. I mean, oh, my God. You know, it's sad as a therapist sitting with those clients and watching them go through this.
Mm-hmm. And yet, really, I love that she knew that she needed to express some anger, because it was a betrayal, but if you really love somebody, you want them to be happy.
Right.
And that's the double-edged sword. I mean, if you really love somebody, you want them to be authentic, and you want them to explore who they really are.
Yes. And I had said to him, too, if you truly love her, you have to be willing to, I don't think it's on the tape, but you have to let her have her anger. You need to let her express how it felt to be betrayed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think it was on the tape. But I knew you were going to do some anger work, because that's definitely where she needed to go to be able to let go and to heal and to have forgiveness.
Yes, and a lot of couples don't understand that, although at least the addicts don't understand it.
So how often do you bring the spouse in?
I try to do it as much as possible, at least even if just for a conjoined session, so I can see the relationship through the partner's eyes. Because you know what? You can do a lot of individual work with somebody, and they can take you on a certain route, and they even believe that route, and then their partner walks in, and they're busted. It's all different, right? So I love that, and so that helps me. But a lot of spouses are like, you know, I don't want to come in, or I'd rather us go to a more neutral therapist. I don't even want to see you, and so that's okay. You know, there's so much emotion around it that I do it as much as I can.
Well, and I got to tell you, Joe, I think that happens definitely more often than not, that there's a whole different picture that we don't get on an individual basis. And it's not that we need it. It just, again, shows us a different fragment of that person's life that is helpful to know about.
Right, and it might be blind spots that they don't even see.
Absolutely. And even if they do see it and don't necessarily want you to know it, it's only, again, because of their own pain about it.
That's well said. Exactly.
So I so appreciate you helping share your mission of sexual health. And, you know, I love the fact that you reframe sexual addiction, because it really can be a good thing. It can bring out the monster inside, and then you can learn how to manage that and grow from that and be of service to other people. I mean, you're a person that's doing that right now. How many years recovery do you have?
Wow, I've had since I was, I think I went in when I was 24 and I'm 47. So what is that, 23 years?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, people can go to your website. They can look at your videos. They can find out your calendar of events so that you and your colleagues, you know, they don't have to be there in Michigan. They can actually do some teleclasses and all sorts of things. And you've been doing this work for how many years?
I graduated in 86, so 24 years.
Well, Dr. Court, thank you so much for educating all of us, and I just wish you the best. I am so glad there are people out there like you who just have not only the specialized niche, but a real compassion for the trauma and just for the compulsivity that this brings to an addict's life.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah,
it's been a pleasure. Anytime somebody wants me to hear me talk about it and are willing to share this with other people, I'm happy to do it. Thank you.
Okay. You have a great day, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you. You too.